I'd like to introduce J.D. Scrimshire to introduce Elizabeth Weiss.
Great, thanks.
Hi, everybody. Hi. Thanks for coming out tonight. Elizabeth Weiss has taught poetry in preschools, prisons, and nursing homes, as well as to the intellectually disabled. She presently teaches writing and literature at Salem State University. She lives in Marblehead with her husband, Len, where she teaches local history as a docent for the Lee Mansion. They have two grown sons. Her poems have appeared in many reviews, and her chapbook, The Caretaker's Lament, is forthcoming from Finishing Line Press soon. It seems like it's been brewing for a long time. So Liz will be facilitating a generative writing workshop on the unexpected joys and gratitude of caretaking at the Abbott Public Library in Marblehead on Saturday, November 7th. Liz Horowitz.
Liz Weiss. Sorry.
Thank you. So nice to be here. Thanks, JD. Thanks for coming out on such a stormy evening. So lucky to be sharing the stage with Confluence. I've heard JD and Phil before, and just wanted to thank the Gloucester Writers Center for having us. George Carlin once said, "There are nights when the wolves are silent and only the moon howls." I've always been a fan of the moon and not always of music, and sometimes music distracts me. I lose my train of thought. And I have to work harder to hear my own music. I have to be silent then, and a lot. I know that's hard for many of you who know me to believe. But it's really distressing to explain to people, my kids, my students, and my husband, that I don't really love music. But when I was listening to the Rolling Stones in the gym earlier, I realized I really, when I do have it on, I need to completely concentrate on it. I can't do other things at the same time. Maybe poetry is my music because it's really insisting that I don't share my brain space with other sounds. So I think I can just do one at a time. For tonight, I've just tried to pull together some of my poetry that resonates through pattern and form. And I realize this might be as close to lyric as I can get. It's really my writing that I felt was fueled by sound and pitch. And as a child of the 60s and 70s, schooled mostly in deep image and confessional writing, I think it's kind of been a surprise and a delight to play with form and pattern. So thanks for letting me share my playlist with you. And I'm going to begin with a very old poem about wanting to play the saxophone after hearing Art Blakey and his jazz messengers in Paris on the right bank in 1983. Vox Humana. After hours on the Point Royale, I told you how the saxophone separated you from me. I needed that wail of darkness not innately human, and you, in gratitude, bought one for me. Brass and tinny, I blew my heart away. That cold spring the violets didn't open, and our two-year-old ran through the yard sale on the wet lawn, ripping off tags as if it could save anything. The dealers under their black umbrellas profited from objects I found impossible. I remember the saxophone's green case splitting open, the instrument golden. Before moving close to the water, renovating rooms of their damp fallen plaster, I thought it would be simple. Boxes emptied, our real estate ready to show. I don't know why I gave it up. Time, the weather, the babysitters canceling. I thought I could be disciplined, build with my hands, a sound so deep we would enter it, pressing on keys, which no longer turn, in the doors we have left open behind us. My next poem mentions music. It's a guzzle, a poem written in couplets. The same word is mentioned in every couplet, and in the last couplet, I have to mention my proper name. This is Nocturne. We accelerate through red traffic lights, playing hide and seek with stars,
past the observatory and the National Cathedral, we are praying, two silent film stars, making our way to the little house. If the midwives arrive in time, I will thank my lucky stars. I want so much to hold your gravity on your first night in the Milky Way under stars. When you arrive, I will sing to you if you cry and hum and tap the beat to the tune of pop stars so that every moment will be one of music. I'll sing of the spheres and of how the sun is a star, the sky divided into 88 acres. There's no turning back. Stellar remnant, white dwarf, neutron star. We'll form a constellation, the three of us, a whirling mass of gas and dust to make one bigger star. I push into a black hole, gaping in the grass. Your father times each contraction by the stars. As we wait, he shouts Elizabeth to call me back, not knowing that when a star is born, there is also a collapse. Every summer, I try to read all of the work of one poet and read criticism about them as well, or books, biographies, whatever I can find. And I did Anne Bradstreet, one of our local girls from a while ago. And I started to hear like sounds that were rhymey, and I didn't know what to do with it, but I just have these two, and I thought they were kind of fun, and I just pulled them out. This one is Pretty Dresses. All my life I've been distracted by pretty dresses, all that is well cut and stitched and rich to touch. My closet as evidence, too much of a good thing really is too much. Clothed in abundance, I examine my weakness. Pretty dresses serve as sail to get me out of what I long to flee, myself for setting sights on what I can only steal. For moments becoming someone else, though how I am clothed in the eyes of the world matters less than what I wear when this world of pleasure I leave. Let me at least complete some scribbled notes before I gather up my well-worn cloaks, protecting the dress that lies beneath. Let me cheat, though I know the rule, that in midst of grief nothing can console. A perfect dress gives momentary cover, at least, from work undone and quarrels of the soul. And the next one I wrote that summer is called After 50. It has a little refrain. That's musical, right? After 50, dinner parties are easy. Nothing burns, meat gets braised. Your hands know how to gently whisk swirls of Dijon into mayonnaise. After 50, you know your oven well. There's no need to adjust the racks. You don't need a timer. You're relaxed. All that could go wrong already did. The silver comes out. It goes back in. Platters might shatter, but all is forgiven. When stiff or sore or scorched, you can sit back and take a drink, slowly mixing and breathing in the raspberry rhubarb cream. You know what's important and what to say, and that it's all right for silence to descend like a king demanding loyalty of his subjects who know the sweetness of a shared bitterness. What once seemed too much no longer is. After 50, you raise your glass to all that's good for all the brokenness of the past and transmutations of your various selves. You know your spouse is just your spouse. You can add a little pepper or a little salt to the wounds, but all their faults are also yours. There is forgiveness and dessert, and a world within the world, and a place to rest far from the distant glimmer that endures after 50. And just to introduce you to my neighborhood and my childhood, I have a portrait of a neighbor who was a Catholic school teacher, and weekends she just watched those old movies that used to be on Saturday afternoon, I think it was, those old black and white ones. Elaine Capelli, this is for her. Lost Footage. Weekends found her splayed in her parents' living room, where none of her parochial school charges could reach her with their untied Oxfords and dormant smells of chalk and glue. Perched in an easy chair, afternoon slipped into worn grooves. She watched black and white movies, frame by granular frame, the soundtrack crackling. Sometimes there was popcorn, an extra pillow, or a bathrobe, and compulsory slippers. She snorted when endings were obvious, smirked at DAR-like actresses, ignorant ingenues who puckered and trilled over Bakelite phones. She abandoned herself to the obsolete, making me think she still loved the world outside her window, even if she never looked. It was the height of the 60s. We still ate fish on Fridays, and her brother hadn't yet tripped into the merciless jungles of Vietnam. Unmarried, where else was there to be but in the interval, the commercial, switching channels, keeping control? Here she was queen, critic, goddess, to all she knew and all she cared to know of that odd bluish light glow to which we were all obedient. You remember the Vietnam War was on the news every night. You remember the scene? It was unbelievable. It went into my dreams as a child all the time. And we lived a few doors up in a redwood house on top of a hill. And this is taking place in the house. This poem is from my chapbook, which should be coming out in a few weeks, called The Caretaker's Lament from Finishing Line Press. Home Repairs. Mother loved us, and then she took it back, filling the whole house with her sadness. She disappeared for days. We waited in the grass while she drove over the narrows, a small bird caught. Mother tried to fix each broken thing with a hammer and awl, but then gave up. Roots grew gnarled around eroded pipes. Icicles crashed to the slate path. Repairmen showed pity, or they never came back. No one ever considered uprooting the trees so that light would enter our house and we could see past the ruddy vines into other houses on the block where people came and went without too much thought. We slept head to toe on the sagging porch, afraid to call the ambulance and watch her strapped. We begged the police not to hurt her, and so the years went. And the trees grew stronger than we were. The house shook in its frame during the long nights we were shy strangers. Clouds of Thorazine hung outside the picture window, waiting for her to wake. When I cleaned that house for the last time before it was sold, I came home to write this poem about it. It's called Chevra Kadisha. Chevra Kadisha is a group of community volunteers who care for the dead from death to burial, and a shomer guards over the dead in Jewish tradition. One radio station is mentioned out of New York City, classical radio station, is WQXR. Chevra Kadisha. Taking each numb limb lovingly, washing each corner with care, sweeping the baseboards to shampoo your body for the last time, all impurities gone, all chances gone, all breath taken away. I outline the red shock of your body, wipe the smoky perfume of your dress, crumbled in the closet. I walk down the thorny path through the door knocker threshold where I am the sweeper, the shomar, the guard, and the keeper. Constellations once floated above your chimney, and your rooftop belted out song, and starlight ran down your long gutters in fits of rain. Rising and settling, you had your enemies. When scotch tape held ceiling tiles in place and bats and raccoons were forced to find another place to hide. You will be dressed and dried, though it's getting late. You will return to your former dignity. Before I change the locks in the blue kitchen, before I silence the strains of WQXR, I will ask for forgiveness on high for anything I may have done to offend. I will sit with you, wash you, lie with you in your redwood coffin until you are taken for burial, until it is twilight, until I can stand on the threshold and hold on to you one last time, as it is written. My mother did come to stay with us for 10 months, and though she was bipolar, we were able to medicate that, and then it became obvious that she had dementia, and we cared for her, and that involved full-time care of maybe every 5 minutes her asking what was, you know, she had sort of just asked the same question again, and those of you who've dealt with dementia realize how difficult it is. But I wouldn't have given up one day of that, really. We had fun. The caretaker's lament. O mother of my sucking thumb, wedged into a body bipolar and dumb, struck with loss of thought. O Lydia of the fallen, sick, wounded, coffee-eyed beauty, I dress your fluid limp limb, shower your baby hair and blow it fine, kiss your hammered toes with powder, and place your feet in soles strong enough to hold your weight and mine. We stand outside of time, climbing the jagged ridge of what memory allows, balancing each other over the ditch's gullet where meaning is beside the point. The dragon's barrow is empty after all. Gold turns to rust, and all that is material evaporates into a heap of dust. O mother, eternally drawn to my side, whatever the battle, I feel you in my bone house. Love that nature makes does not dissolve but deepens. The world is round. We have come this far. We are where we begin again. Whatever I have of worth is yours. I lie with you. I frame your form in mine. After she passed away, my father came to stay for 3 years, and it was apparent at one point that he forgot how to tie a tie, which he did every day for work. He always did it backwards, you know. I don't know why. The four in hand is a kind of a tie. I don't know what exactly it looks like, but... And then so I braid a few different stories here. He was kicking a soccer ball in a lot in the Bronx when the Hindenburg went over just a few minutes later. It blew up. And he was also in World War II. So I braided a few of those stories together with his ties. The four in hand. My father forgot how to tie a tie, the knot, the double loop. He kicked a soccer ball while the Hindenburg flew. The knot, the double loop. It's the Windsor or the four in hand, while the Hindenburg flew, a spark ignited, leaking hydrogen. It's the Windsor or the four in hand, tighten by sliding it up the narrow end, a spark ignited, leaking oxygen. He caught shrapnel as an infantryman. Tighten by sliding it up the narrow end, the tourniquet was in the first aid kit. He caught shrapnel as an infantryman. Below Verdun in a field at night. The tourniquet was in the first aid kit. Take the wide side around the neck, tighten a bit. Below Verdun in a field at night, he thought that was it. Take the wide side around the neck, tighten a bit. The mine goes in and the mine goes out. He thought that was it. Sparks jump from the fabric to the frame. The mine goes in and the mine goes out. My father reads only headlines now. Sparks jump from the fabric to the frame. Nothing will ever be the same. My father reads only headlines now. A mushroom-shaped flame burst into bloom. Nothing will ever be the same. adjust the narrow slide through the hoop. And then he was gone, and I thought about them both together and wrote this elegy for my parents. My Adam and my Eve, my north and my south, I leaned on you, we swayed, and time beat a crazy current more powerful than hooves pawing at stall gates, eyes wild, knowing of the coming rains. When the storm breaks and we retrace the slippery, silvery watermarks of what we did not say, could I leave you again behind in the wake? How late were we? How startled the neighbors? How dandelion filled our lawn, how broken into pieces like bitter chocolate. Slowly, slowly, in the great grooves of the mind, I find you both again, wandering lost children, asleep in the haystack, holding hands, dressed in rags. I don't want to let you go, nor can I be with you, so I dig my muddy spurs in. We could meet somewhere, on a road to an unmarked Viennese cafe, that is small enough to hold your singular breath. I believe I was willed to be your child, to remember the old encircling rhyme of Johnny Johnny gone to sea, silver buckles on his knee, he'll come home and marry me, you both in your gauze, in your haze, in your breakdowns, in your hospital gowns, in your pills, in your pillows of down. How could you surrender to the elongated shadows of the trains? Hear me out. I thought you brave enough to be partisans. Wait for me till, like cargo, I unload the heaviness of your weight, not a burden, but a heaviness I drag in twilight, stuck between this station and the next. I watch azaleas open pink, larva-like they hover, fine babies' tongues wet under quilted cover. And now the end begins, and toward the sea I live, where long ago you rocked me, I swim to where you are, translucent shell of childhood, strung from tree to tree. What's left to say? I gave you my voice when yours were weak, and now I have none, just a bunch of rags, my heart, my lungs, my mother, my father, my left side, my right. I windmilled your names, I turned and churned, I worked and played, I listened, I did as you said, in the redwood house on the hill where you were deposed like Nicholas and Alexandra, and now to myself I could not be led. O time and solitude who hold the reins, let me be glad of the seasons, loop me under the dark, crush me with your scent. My flesh is pulled back, my grief is raw. Your shoes are still by the door. And I think I'm just going to end right there. So thank you very much. Thank you. I would love to introduce the next two people who are going to be up here. In 2007, musician Phil Swanson and author J.D. Scrimgeour created the performance group Confluence, which integrates poetry and music and specializes in long narrative pieces. The group has been featured performers at many venues, including the Robert Frost Place, the Newburyport Literary Festival, and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs annual conference. The group's first CD, Algonquit, and Other Works, was produced by Grammy Award winner Richard Price and released by MSR Classics in 2010. It was featured twice on the Indie Feed Performance Poetry podcast, where the host, Wes Jolie, said of the piece, Algonquit, I haven't heard such a heartfelt, powerful tribute poem since Ginsberg's Kaddish. You'll hear some excerpts from Algonquit tonight, as well as some new work. J.D. and Phil?
I'm going to say a little bit about this piece to set it up. As Liz said, we do a lot of long narrative pieces which mix poetry and music. This piece, the first piece, is a little bit different. For one thing, we're just trying this out, so you folks are, we're kind of workshopping it here with you. The other thing is that even though this is fairly long and it has a lot of elements of narrative, it's also got elements of collage. In particular, it's got a whole bunch of citations from other texts studded throughout this piece. And I wouldn't be a teacher if I didn't bring a handout for you. So this has all the quotations that are in the text, and I'm passing this out. Please, I think there's almost enough copies. But just so if you want to sort of follow along at these moments where these quotations come in. I'll try to modulate my voice a little bit, but just to give you a heads up. The other reason it's a little bit more like a collage than some of the other pieces that we've done is that in the middle of it, you'll hear briefly a couple other voices. Those voices are the voices of two Trojan warriors from the Virgil's Aeneid, Nisus and Euryalus. They're minor characters in the Aeneid, and basically all they do is they sneak over to the enemy camp and slaughter lots of people while they're sleeping, and then when they're trying to get back, they get captured and killed themselves. So I mention that because that actually is about the origins of this piece. This piece really began when Phil called my attention to a little piece in the New York Times about the way that those who were killed in the 9/11 attack at the World Trade Center were being memorialized. And specifically, over their remains, there is this line from Virgil's Aeneid, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time." But that line that line was referring in the Aeneid to Nisus and Euryalus, who are two kind of cold-blooded murderers. And so it seemed kind of odd and ironic that it was being taken out of context and used in this regard. So what does one do when faced with that fact? Well, what did I do? I actually went back and reread the Aeneid. I think the last thing that you need to know, if you haven't been brushing up on your Virgil, is that the Aeneid is the story of Aeneas, a person escaping from Troy as it's burning, and it talks about him going to eventually found what becomes Rome. Perhaps the most famous episode in the Aeneid is the love story of Dido and Aeneas. Yeah, good. And in which Dido, the queen of Carthage, takes Aeneas and his men in when their ships land there. They have a love affair, but then the gods and fate drive Aeneas to kind of sneak out to go found Rome. And so Dido, who is despairing and enraged because she can't quite grab him and bring him back. She builds a giant pyre and then climbs it and kills herself as Aeneas and his ships disappear in the horizon. So I think it helps. You'll see why. It just sort of helps to get a little bit of that. I probably gave you too much. But I guess the last thing I wanted to say about this was Phil made a number of important discoveries while we were putting this piece together. One, he sort of recognized that the spirit of Aaron Copland was in the tone of Copland was in some of the words here. And so you'll hear sort of echoes of Copland, I think, in some of the stuff he composed. And also Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas, he remembered that, and he ended up taking a famous piece from that, Dido's Lament, and you're actually going to hear some of that underneath some of these words.
Yeah, the way we generally work is J.D. will write one of these long narrative poems. This is 24 minutes. Mm-hmm. And give it to me. And then I kind of, it's similar perhaps to writing a film score, where here's the text, okay, deal with it. And so in searching for a voice, what came to me was Copeland, and who grew up in New York, and Lincoln Portrait, and this kind of expansive, it just seemed to resonate. And then as I read, I noticed this reference to the Dido, and it's like, oh, that's the Purcell. That's a very, very famous scene from an opera by Henry Purcell in the 1680s, so it was already in the text. So, and a lot of what you hear on the music is part of it's improvised, some of it's composed, and it's kind of a mix of, I might have a general conception, but it's going to be different every time, most of it.
Great.
That's a little bit how we work.
Yep. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. This is the last thing I'll say, is that this piece was also composed differently because it was begun from the beginning, imagined as a performance piece. So it really, I wasn't thinking about these words on the page. It really is meant to be done with Phil. Could we just do a real quick sound check? You want to just play a little something and I'll recite like 2 seconds? My heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the veins 1 minute past. Yes? Can you hear me? Yes?
Okay. Yes.
Great. Words, days, flames. At the National September 11th Memorial Museum, a stark wall separates visitors from a repository containing about 8,000 unidentified human remains. On the wall, commemorating those who died in the attack, is a 60-foot-long inscription in 15-inch letters made from the steel of the Twin Towers. No day shall erase you from the memory of time. Virgil. It sounds fitting, except in the context of Book 9 of the Aeneid, from which it is translated. There, a reader learns who Virgil is commemorating, who his you are. You are not nameless. You are Nisus and Euryalus. You do not number in the thousands. You are two. You are not civilians. You are Trojan soldiers. You have not been thrown together by cruel chance. You are a loving pair. Your deaths are not unprovoked. You have just slaughtered the enemy in an orgy of violence, skewering soldiers whom you ambushed in their sleep. For this, the enemy has killed you and impaled your heads on spears. There are days that erase you. Days where the sky is so deep and unfathomably blue, it seems to contain all the world's memories and all its dreams. You can know none of it, but feel an ache from that well of blue, that expanse stretching you as it stretches itself. September 11th was one of those days. Not the towers melting, not the panic, the pink mist in the streets, but the waking and driving our children to school, returning home to make love, the morning air with its nip of autumn, that soul-stinging blue sky, almost too rich to be in the bedroom, though the windows were open, the music of the morning melding with our music. My friends were gone. Some spent with toil, some with despair oppressed, leapt headlong from the heights. The flames consumed the rest. It must be true, yes, there were witnesses. Who they were, no one knows, but two people, strangers, friends, lovers, no one knows, held hands before they leapt from the tower and the flames that had chased them to the edge. The first time I held hands with a girl, I was 12, walking a middle school hallway, in the dull metal shimmer of the lockers like a knife, the voices of schoolmates charged because I held her hand, and in that touch, possibility. How long since that touch and this one, my pen scrolling across the page, in a Lynn, Massachusetts deli, scrawling and crossing out words while the customers and proprietor speak Spanish and a heavy metal band in the basement apartment shakes the floorboards. How long since that hand, those lockers, possibility? How long after Dido's pyre until Virgil picked up his pen and scrawled, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time." How long after she stepped up and up, climbing the fine gifts she had given him, bare feet sinking into the rich clothing, bruising on the hard treasures, goblets, plates, all that would soon be blackened, all that would soon be smoke, flakes of ash. The pyre built with all she had given him, every vestment, every treasure, the jeweled sword she drove into her chest. She wanted to erase the trace of him, to make it seem as if he had never lived, nor her. And Virgil, at his court-appointed desk, conjuring the flame and the tears, the ships easing into the horizon, Aeneas's grimace. In that span between deed and word, how much transpired? The births and funerals, the legions of warriors, the copulation and flares of imagination among so many. Citizens, slaves, courtesans, artisans, all in that span between the ship's last glimpse backward at the fire and Virgil's glimpse backward at the fire. The quote speaks to the indelibility of our memories. In selecting this quote, our focus was not on the specific narrative of the classic story, nor its characters. Remember me, forget my fate, but ah, remember me. No day shall erase you from the memory of time. No day shall save you from the anonymity of time. What fun to live in an empire. You feel superior. You can afford guilt. You look at places with no clean water, at places where food is scarce, and you say, there but for the grace. And then you run your road race, or text your friend about her date. You buy organic food or Burger King. You write an angry poem or two. We all desire to live in an empire. So much is done for you. So, let's sneak over, cut the watchman's throat, then kill as many as we can while they're sleeping. And by the way, you know, I love you. And not like a friend. After they had snuck into the enemy camp and slaughtered several in their sleep, drawing blood from body parts I'd never known, a weasel, a brain pan, they hurried back, but the glint of a stolen helmet gave them away. More death. That's the story here. And Virgil, with his promise to commemorate. Do you ever wonder if long after we're dead, they'll think we all believed that shit about gods, the underworld, the lies we're born into? Those poor superior saps. I wonder if they'll evolve so they don't regret killing. Erect a lofty pile, exposed in air. As my father taught me, I built a cone of twigs, with larger, thicker branches crossing above, then crumpled yesterday's newspaper, eased it underneath, struck a match and watched the flame flare high and orange, watched the twigs catch and twist in the heat, drop black to the ground, the branches not catching, the fire fading to flicker, to spark, then out. I can never keep it lit. When a match is struck, the friction caused by the glass powder rubbing together produces enough heat to turn the red phosphorus into white phosphorus, which catches fire and air. This small amount of heat starts a chemical reaction that uses the oxidizing agent to produce oxygen gas. The heat and oxygen gas then cause the sulfur to burst into flame. A strike anywhere match works similarly, but instead of phosphorus being on the striking surface, it is added to the head of the match. You can tell the difference between the two types of matches by looking at the colors of the match heads. The plane, the match, the building, the strip. No, the building, the match, the sky, the strip. No, the words, the match, the mind, the strip. What is it to be inside a match head? What was it to be inside those planes? What is inside your head? Do you remember Virgil? Do you remember Aeneas? Do you, for as long as you live, say the names of those who died in the towers? Do you recall Nisus and Euryalus? Do you know what they did? We lie. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. The days after, my sons and I spent hours in our small backyard. I flipped balls into the sky and they ran. They leapt, they dove. It was a quiet sky, the bobbing branches, a corner of the neighbor's house, some clouds, sparrows and grackles. The planes had evaporated, no streaming contrails, and the world seemed less connected. The people in New York, D.C., the people in Afghanistan were almost imaginary. Some people in a dream who, now I was awake, could not be quite envisioned. What was here was what we had. A mangy tennis ball, a dirt backyard, two boys in dusty shorts, their munchkin voices filling the afternoon with, yes, joy. The best advice is what any old con will tell you. Walk slow, drink a lot of water. And so, those weeks after, I walked slow and stayed hydrated. Each morning, with my bowl of Raisin Bran, I poured myself a glass of water. And each morning, my stomach would resist. I'd eat a few bites and sigh. For over a month, a few spoonfuls of cereal every morning, then I'd stop, appetite gone. News of anthrax in Afghanistan bubbled from the radio. And then one day, did some god intervene? It struck me. Water with cereal tastes awful. My uncle worked in Veterans Affairs, a building down the street from the towers. What he saw out his window, I've never asked. Weeks after, he could hardly leave his room. And then one day, he and a friend, a Muslim friend, volunteered together, passing out sandwiches to the laborers down near the wreckage, breathing in the contaminated air. Simple, mindless work. Plain conversation. Until the day became any busy day in the city, and he felt better. No day shall erase you. What's a day? A revolution, turning toward, then away. And every day erases the one before. And loss, we drink it every moment. So many. Who can keep score? Every second, one more step away from the act. One more chance to revise. Virgil, I don't know that anyone cares about you. Perhaps we should just erase your name. Let the words stand alone. Metal letters fastened to the stone. No day shall erase you from the memory of time. They're not your words anyway, but the translators. And in Dryden's version, it's about fame, not forgetting. Your fame shall ever live, he, Virgil, Dryden, promises. Oh, they'll take your words and make them do their work. The dead, who were just going about their day, were turned to heroes, warriors, the famed, and used to spur the country to war. Against who? It really didn't matter. With wonder as they went, the troops were filled to see such numbers whom so few had killed. When you hear hero, think victim. When you hear brave, think trapped. When you hear tragedy, think disaster. When you hear sky, think sky. When you hear innocent, think who among us. When you hear hate, think human. When you hear Americans murdered, think Dominican, Japanese, British. Think American, Salvadorian, Canadian, Israeli, German, Mexican. When you hear American, think. When you hear Pentagon, think military strike on an enemy's command center. When you hear conspiracy, think conspiracy. When you hear hero, think victim. When you hear no day shall erase you, think, yeah, right. When you hear no day shall erase you, think two soldiers ambushing and slaughtering the enemy. When you hear no day shall erase you, think of yesterday and what you remember of it and who you thought of. When you hear the phrase, the memory of time, think, does time remember? When you hear words, listen. We'll just do a little bit from our Algonquin piece, and that'll be it. Just to give you a taste of it. So let's just do the first section.
Oh, sure. Do that, okay. Whatever.
When so it's just like 3 minutes or something. They were 4 minutes. Okay. But just to give you, this is from our CD, which we're hawking too. So.
That's a discounted price.
Should stop in the middle of a lot.
Yeah.
There you go. You got it.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is called the Algonquin. This is just the first section of it. I don't think I need to set it up. There's a faint brownish stain on the pale green rug in our family room, half under the futon sofa. I noticed it today while I was sharing gossip about work with Eileen, someone drunk at a Christmas party. And I looked down and forgot what I'd been saying. The memory unfolding of my Uncle John spilling his coffee when he came to visit a month after the diagnosis, how he'd felt so bad, and how he confessed. He couldn't help but wonder whether it was the tumor that made him clumsy. Exchanging glances with his wife, Kathy, that were tinged with fear. And later, when we went bowling and John could barely finish a string. And that evening when they came to watch my son's Little League game and it poured in the first inning and we all stood under an oak that we knew would not let up and the game would be canceled and lightning forked the sky. And I confess, just after the memory the stain evoked, the thought, this should go in the poem. And I looked harder at it, like Bishop looks hard in her poems. For her, it leads to clarity, epiphanies. But for me, the spot became less defined, the darker outline blurring with the green until it was as nebulous as the ocean, green tinged with brown, the shades of lamplight and sunlight layering what had been there and what still may have been there. A fish could have leapt from that carpet at that moment. And I turned my eyes blankly to Eileen as she sat on the futon, waiting for my story's next word. Thanks.